The following is a production of the Florida State University Department of Religion. On March 1, 2013, Dr. Robert Jamello, Research Professor of Theology and Eastern Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Notre Dame, gave a lecture on esoteric Buddhism in a time of turbulence as part of the Tessa Bartholomew's lecture series provided annually by the Department of Religion. This production is copyright to the Florida State University and Robert Jamello, all rights reserved, and the runtime is approximately 1 hour and 45 minutes.
Hello everyone, thank you all for coming. My name is Dr. Yu, and I'm the East Asian Buddhism and Religion faculty member in the Department of Religion. This year, we had the honor to invite the 12th Bartholomew's lecture series speaker. And I'm so pleased to be with all of you this afternoon to have the chance to introduce Dr. Robert Jamello. He's currently the research professor of theology and East Asian languages and culture at the University of Notre Dame. Over the past 40 years, he has taught at Dartmouth, University of California, Santa Barbara, University of Arizona, Harvard University, and now he's at Notre Dame. Dr. Jamello has been one of the leading scholars in the study of Chinese Buddhism for decades. And today I found out that he was a teacher of one of my mentors when the latter was doing his undergraduate study at Dartmouth, inspiring him was Dr. Stevenson, to pursue Buddhist studies. His dozens of published work on Buddhist history, soteriology, and thought as embedded in literary culture, milieu, demonstrate his mastery over an array of genres, from doctrinal texts to lay literary writings, to even travel logs. All of these were must-reads for graduate students. When I was a graduate student, we savored over his writings. And his research, in a way, exemplifies a shift in East Asian Buddhist studies from textuality to visuality, doctrine to history. And the period that he works on, primarily 7th century, beginning in 7th century, but later gradually moving on to 12th century, 13th century. But his recent book monograph project, however, has moved him to the 17th century, a tumultuous time of dynastic transition in China for the Ming Dynasty, beginning of the Qing Dynasty. His topic for this afternoon is esoteric Buddhism in a time of turbulence. Without further ado, please join me to welcoming Dr. Jamello.
Thank you, Professor Yu, for that very kind, too generous introduction. It's a pleasure for me to be here, to meet some old friends and to meet a number of new faces. My first visit to Tallahassee, this is, and I'm looking forward to seeing a little bit more of your campus after our lecture before I return to the snowy north. As Professor Yu mentioned, my topic today has to do with a certain kind of Buddhism that we commonly call esoteric Buddhism. You may have heard other names applied to it, like tantric Buddhism. As it was practiced in China during a period of violent transition from one dynasty, the Ming, China's last native dynasty, to the subsequent dynasty, the Qing, China's last dynasty, during which China was ruled by Manchus rather than Han Chinese. This was a very difficult time for China, and particularly for those who were still loyal to the declining Ming regime, who are often called as a group the Ming Loyalists. Chinese literati and officials and scholars and artists who were deeply disturbed by the imminent fall of the Ming Dynasty and who often found it both compelling in a spiritual sense but also practical in a political sense to take refuge from all of this turbulence by becoming Buddhist monks. Usually when people talk about Buddhism in this period, by which I mean late 16th and the 17th centuries, they assume that Buddhism in general was in decline in China. That's long been the common assumption, that Buddhism enjoyed its heyday in China up until the 9th century, roughly, and that thereafter it was in a steady decline. That view of Buddhism's decline in the early modern period is no longer widely held by scholars, but you'll still encounter it. However, even those scholars who focus on Buddhism in the later period from the 10th through the 19th century have tended to assume that such Buddhism as continued to be an important ingredient in Chinese religious and secular culture was largely either Chan Buddhism, what we know in the West primarily as Zen Buddhism, or a kind of devotional Buddhism, which is commonly characterized as Pure Land Buddhism. The tradition I'm going to talk about today fits neatly into neither of those categories. We call it esoteric Buddhism, Mijiao in Chinese, the mystical or the secret or the occult teaching. And that was thought to have had a very short lifespan in China, flourishing in the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries, and then all but disappearing from China. What I and others have learned in recent years, however, is that this kind of Buddhism, esoteric Buddhism, or as some people call it, Chinese tantric Buddhism, actually continued as an important ingredient in the later traditions of Buddhism. Before I get down, however, to my the more formal part of my presentation, I wanted to share with you some images so that you'll have a clearer understanding of these visual understanding of what I mean by esoteric Buddhism. So I've prepared a number of slides here on this PowerPoint presentation, and we'll look at them in sequence, and I'll explain each one and then embark on my talk proper. This is an image of a very important deity in the esoteric Buddhist tradition, who is known by her Sanskrit name either as Chundi or Chunda, but known in China primarily the name Junti, a Chinese transliteration of the Sanskrit. And I've given here on the screen various ways in which her name was written in Chinese and pronounced. She's also known by an epithet, not her personal name, but a title that was conferred on her, and I've given that as well. In Sanskrit, she's known as Saptakoti Buddha Bhagavati, which I think is properly translated as the Buddha Goddess of the 70 million. But if you read this title only in its Chinese version, you might misunderstand it to mean something different. And many Chinese have, over the centuries, understood this title, reading from the Chinese, to mean the mother of the 70 million Buddhas. Right? I won't bore you with the technical issue, but the term Buddha Bhagavati in Sanskrit literally means Buddha goddess or Buddha queen, but for some reason when the Chinese translated that Sanskrit word into Chinese, they used the word mother, and that's led to the common assumption that this deity is somehow the progenitrix of Buddhas. But in fact, she's regarded as a kind of Buddha in her own right, Sometimes she's called a bodhisattva, a Buddha to be. At other times, she's called simply a goddess. But on some occasions, she's actually called a Buddha. And of course, I've been using the feminine pronoun. She is a female deity, right? What you have here is a painting of her that dates from the period under discussion this afternoon, the late Ming Dynasty. We can't date this painting precisely. We don't even know the name of its artist, but it probably dates from the late 16th, early 17th century, and was incorporated very early on into the imperial art collection. So today it's in the National Palace Museum in Taipei. And you can see I've given its dimensions here. It's a gorgeous painting. Gold ink on a vibrant blue silk background. And the deity depicted here is depicted in her standard form. She's shown with a full complement of 18 arms, 3 eyes, and a standard set of regalia and gestures being made with her various hands. She's seated in meditation posture upon a lotus throne. The stalk of the lotus throne is flanked by 2 subordinate deities who are known as Naga kings, Naga rajas, sort of serpent deities from the Indian mythological tradition. They even have names, Nanda and Upananda. And floating above her are other heavenly deities who are witnessing her presence. And in the lower right is depicted a devotee of this goddess, a practitioner of the liturgical rites that are centered on this particular goddess. And what you see here in a particularly gorgeous form is the standard iconographic representation of the deity. This, hard to see. I wonder, would it be easier for people to see the screen if these lights here were dimmed? Is that possible? Yeah. I'm not sure where the... That sort of washes out the color here. That's better. Yeah, thanks. This is another representation of the goddess. Is that all right? Yeah, maybe better. This is not the easiest image to discern on a screen, but this is also a Ming Dynasty painting, also in the National Palace Museum in Taipei, which depicts the goddess in the same form, different colors, but essentially the same 18-armed, 3-eyed female deity seated on a lotus throne, flanked by 2 Naga kings, who are beginning in this version of her depiction to morph into Chinese Nagas, or what we better know as dragons. You'll see they're in human form here, but you'll notice dragon tails peeking up from the clouds in which they're standing, the water in which they're standing. I draw your attention in black and white now to this circular emblem located above her. In this version of her depiction, which is what we call a dharani, a spell or mystical formula or magical formula, which is somehow identified with the goddess. And the identification is such that the Buddhist tradition says, in fact, that the dharani, the sequence of syllables written here in Sanskrit letters, is in fact the vocal or sonic manifestation of the deity. Or, in reverse, it's said that the deity is herself the anthropomorphic manifestation of this sacred spell, or dharani. So we speak of the Chundi dharani, and there it is, spelled out in Roman letters for you. Nama saptanam samyak sambuddha kotinam tadyata om chale chule chunde swaha. The last few syllables, the last 9 syllables printed here in yellow, are the core of the dharani, and the preceding syllables are by way of introduction to that core. This dharani also commonly figures in depictions of the deity, and it figures especially importantly in the practices surrounding this particular deity. There is another rendition of that same dharani in a script known as Siddham, one of the scripts used in ancient times in East Asia, and still today in modern Japan, to inscribe Sanskrit. But sometimes the dharani is written in the form of Chinese characters, chosen not for their meaning, but for their sound value. So you see on the lower part of the screen that same sequence of syllables written in Chinese syllables, in Chinese characters. One of the delightful discoveries I made early in the study of this goddess is that during the same period we're now discussing, the late Ming, early Qing period in European history, if we can speak of late Ming, early Qing Europe, this goddess was already known. This is a print depicting the goddess that appeared in a book published in Amsterdam in 1667, just a few years after the official fall of the Ming Dynasty in the first couple decades of the Qing Dynasty. An eminent Jesuit scholar named Athanasius Kircher, whom you may know in other connections, published a very important book called China Illustrata, China Illustrated, which was for at least the next century after its publication, one of the major sources of knowledge about China in Europe. And one chapter of this book is devoted to what the author called Chinese mythology, in which he tried to argue a wildly erroneous argument that the deities of the East Asian Buddhist tradition are all transmogrifications of ancient Egyptian deities who had somehow migrated to East Asia. So he says that the goddess the Chinese knew as Junti is actually Cybele or Isis from the ancient Egyptian pantheon. But this image was obviously copied by a Dutch woodblock carver from a painting like the one you just saw, sent back to Europe by one of Athanasius Kircher's Jesuit colleagues. The Jesuits were very active in China at this time and were sending back regularly descriptions of China and artifacts that they collected in China. And this is a very close model, imitation of the Chinese depiction of the deity, even down to the Sanskrit inscription above. So you can see how similar they are if you put them side by side. This is another image that I think it's important to be familiar with as we discuss our topic. You see here two photographs of the front and the back of a handheld mirror, which is an important instrument in the practice of the cult of this goddess. We call it a mirror. It's a bronze mirror. On the left, you see the front side, which is a blank reflecting circle surrounded in Sanskrit by that dharani that I've introduced to you. And on the right, you see the back of the mirror, which has the same dharani, this time printed in Chinese characters, but with the image of the goddess. However, you'll notice that on the mirror, the goddess is not facing us. When we hold the mirror and look at its reverse side, we do not see the face of the goddess, we see her back. The practices associated with this goddess require the use of this mirror in such a way that the practitioner looks at the reflection of his or her own image in the front of the mirror, and then practices a kind of visualization meditation in which he or she sees his or her own face